Stickey versus Ashcroft.
You're Stickey.
Mr. Camilli?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, good morning. My name is Tahir Camilli. I'm standing in front of you on behalf of Margarita Uristegui, the appellant in this case. There were three issues that were briefed. Without waiving the second and third issue, I would like to talk to this court this morning in regards to the first issue. And that is whether the immigration judge and the Board of Immigration Appeals made a mistake by denying Margarita Uristegui's June 24, 2002 motion to vacate an abstention order of removal, which was presented to the immigration judge in Chicago. The most important thing in this case, Your Honors, is the fact of this case. Ms. Uristegui entered the United States in 1990. In October of 1991, her father, a lawful permanent resident of the United States, filed for alien petition for relative.
But wait a minute, Mr. Camilli. In terms of at least the basic decision of the BIA from the IJ's decision, there were substantial inconsistencies in Ms. Uristegui's submissions over the years. For example, was she married? Was she not married? Was, you know, things that really go to the heart of the theories on which she was trying to obtain lawful permanent resident status.
Yes, Judge.
And it seems to me that if the BIA concludes in the end that she has not, at the relevant moment, she has not yet demonstrated her eligibility to stay in the country, it's entitled to remove her, isn't it?
Absolutely, Judge. Judge, what happened, the BIA talked about the 1999 application that for adjustment of status was filed by Ms. Uristegui. Now, we have to realize what happened in 1999 and 2000. There were a lot of schemes in the city of Chicago and county of Cook in regard to notaries filing false applications on behalf of aliens, promising them green card, promising them lawful permanent residency. So what happened is that many of these notaries filled out the applications given to the alien asking for the signature. The same thing happened to this case. Ms. Uristegui, in 1999, filed an application for adjustment of status with INS at that time. That application was baseless. That application was absolutely false based on the promises of the notary. In reality, Ms. Uristegui, in 1999, was not eligible to adjust her status because the priority date based on the lawful permanent resident father was not up at that time. Her prior date was October 31st of 1991. The October 31st, 1991 date came eligible. They became eligible in 2003 to apply for permanent residency. So what BIA is talking about, Judge, is just that circumstances that she filed an application, she was presented an application to sign for adjustment of status in 1999.
There is absolutely you're saying the BIA, though, isn't entitled to in any way take into account the fact that somebody, I realize that what you're talking about is an underlying problem in the system in that people can be taken advantage of by individuals like these notaries, but nonetheless, once things get into the official channels, why can't the BIA just look at the record as it is?
Because we were never given an opportunity to provide a record of our own. What we have been asking the immigration judge to do is to continue the case till the priority date becomes current so we can prove to the immigration judge that Ms. Uristegui was never married, has two children. She stayed single from 1991 till 2003. We have never given that opportunity, Judge. She never had her day in court to prove her case, to prove why 1999 application should not be looked at, why she is eligible for adjustment of status. Those are the reasons we filed a motion to vacate her in absentia hearing, Judge. What happened is that after going to court for twice, two times she appeared in court, April 4, 2001, December 19, 2001. Then she was given a hearing date of June 12, 2002.
Yeah, no, this is the Junio-Julio
exactly,
argument.
The Junio-Julio argument that we have made. Now, the most important thing we have to realize, Judge, the reason behind an absentia hearing and the statute. The statute was not created to punish people who obey the law. In reality, the First Circuit, in the case of Herbert in April of 2003, came up to say that the statute for an absentia hearing was made. These restrictions were adopted in response to a serious problem. And
right,
those
but
are
you know, I have to tell you, I mean, I was not overwhelmed by the thought that a Spanish speaker would have that much trouble distinguishing between Junio and Julio. It seems to me, I mean, you know, we all make these distinctions every day in our native language. And I guess I'm also concerned about the aspect of your case dealing with the BIA's treatment of the motion to remand.
Yes.
Because there was never an IJ ruling, right?
Correct, Judge, because there was no
motion
IRC
filed
available.
Directly with the BIA.
Yes, Your Honor, and we have to, based on the statute, we have to file with the BIA because the IJ did not have jurisdiction on the case when the case is with BIA.
Right.
Now, in regards to the Huni and Julia, Judge, that you're indicating that whether the mistake was made or not, if you look at the record, pages 74 and 75, we see a letter from the employer of Ms. Yersigi indicating that 4 weeks to 6 weeks before the letter was issued, put the date about May 24 to May 25th of 2002, she in reality asked for a day off for July 12th, for Julio 12th, not for June 12th. Now, if she didn't have any intention to come to court or delay the process, why would she ask for July 12th? And those were presented to the BIA. They were presented to the immigration judge when the motion to vacate was filed in June of 2002. Now, in this case, the circumstances of this case is very similar to Singh, which was a decision by the Ninth Circuit. In that case, Mr. Singh he delayed going to court for 3 hours. In that case, the court came back and said that there was no reason for Mr. Singh to delay the proceedings.
He was eligible, but her status is much more dubious. So.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I believe that Ms. Yersigi's, the day that she was ordered deported from the United States, the priority date for Category 2, which is the daughters of a U.S. permanent resident, was October 22nd, 1991. Her priority date was October 31st, 1991. Now, she was not eligible on June 12th, 2002, to ask for adjustment of status, and we do concede to that. But the plan and the judge in this immigration court knew that he may not be eligible. In reality, she was going to ask for another continuance at the way she was asking before, to make her eligible. December of 2002, the priority date became current. So there was no reason for Ms. Yersigi to miss her date. There was no reason for her not to come to court. She was eligible for adjustment of status. She waited 14 years, 12 years, 12 years for the priority date to become current.
But you know, there's something somewhat disturbing by the idea that you just keep getting continuances until these eligibility dates come up. I realize that in a sense is what people have every incentive to try, but Congress, it seems, was trying to shut that off and just get decisions made as soon as possible, even though eligibility dates might come up in the future. They didn't say anybody who one day will become eligible may stay in the country until that date arrives.
Absolutely, Judge. In reality, this honorable court, in the case of Morales, which was issued, I believe, last month, looked at this fact, that whether it's the abuse of discretion for the immigration judges not to continue the case when it's so close for the priority date to become current. She had a great case on this matter.
But that was the case where the judge didn't even consider, you know, there was a failure to exercise discretion as opposed to a negative exercise of discretion.
Judge, if the immigration judges do not continue these cases and they deny, the reality and the practice on the street is the fact that their decision will be denied, it will be appealed to the Board of Immigration Appeals. That automatically binds the alien 6 months, 9 months, makes the Board of Immigration Appeals more crowded, more cases to worry about, then a motion to remand goes in based on the newly found evidence, the priority date has become current, and the case may get remanded to the immigration judge. Would that be a wise decision not to continue the case at the immigration judge level or overcrowd Board of Immigration Appeals in Washington? With all due respect, Judge, I believe we can keep the case at the immigration judge's level to continue the case till the time becomes current if it's close enough. And the immigration judges know that. They know the priority date, Judge. If it's close enough, I strongly believe and I encourage them in every argument I have with immigration judges to continue the case so we don't overcrowd the Board of Immigration Appeals in Washington. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Ms. Drucker?
Tucker representing the United States. I guess the best way for me to start here is not only would I like to win this case, but I'd like to win this case on a particular ground. I feel that to some extent,
well,
before you get too enthusiastic, I have a real problem with the board's treatment of the motion to remand, because as you well know, the per curiam order here says the board affirms without opinion the results of the decision below. Well, there of course is no decision below in the motion to remand, because the motion to remand was addressed directly to the board. And so there is nothing there, and the logic of our opinion in the Georges case, which we've followed, and I'm sure you know, in many, many, many other cases, when the board issues this rubber stamp order, we live with it because we can turn to the immigration judge's opinion and ascertain what rationale there is. Well, nothing and nothing is nothing. If the case was never before the immigration judge, and there is no immigration judge decision, and there is no explanation or decision, this order is utterly meaningless.
Well, our position is that the fact that the board didn't separately make a decision on the remand, that basically the remand followed upon the motion to reopen.
How do we know that? You are making so many assumptions. Just to ask the board to rule on a motion which is presented to it. Suppose this court just completely ignored petitions that you file with us, and we said, well, trust us. We're back there in our chambers thinking about it. How would you know? Well, I mean, there needs to be some sort of public record of what was the motion? What were the grounds? Why was it dismissed? I'm sure you could do it in a paragraph, but we have no evidence whatsoever that your speculation is correct.
Well, if you'll give me a moment, I'll try to explain the logic. Our logic is that the board was denying the motion to reopen on the fact that the petitioner had not shown extraordinary circumstances.
What are the results of the decision below that are referred to in the motion to remand?
I'm sorry?
What results of the decision below are being referred to, not in the motion to reopen, but in the motion to remand?
The motion to remand was on the various, supposed material evidence that related to equities, that related to eligibility for relief that the petitioner had gained. But the board was not interested in looking at the eligibility question because in the view of the board, and we believe that this is correct, under Congress's guidance, that was not the issue they should have been looking at.
How
should
we
know
that?
Looking at,
I mean, you may be 100% right, but what evidence do we have from this two-sentence order with one cite that any of that happened?
I don't think that there is written evidence in the record,
no.
Your Honor. I agree with you on that point. But I think...
And we don't even know if the whole board looked at it. We don't even know if the whole board is supposed to look at it under these summary procedures, which are designed for IJ.
I think we have the question of intrinsic logic that if one issue, determines the entire ball of wax, there isn't an independent need to then go on and talk about an issue that has never been, that needn't be reached, that is totally irrelevant in this context. That's our position on the remand. And what I'm trying to suggest, Your Honors, is this case all hinges on this question of the failure to appear, which can only be excused, if you will, if there are exceptional circumstances. The statute is extraordinarily clear about what is required. These circumstances must be beyond the control of the alien. They include serious illness of the alien or the death of an alien spouse, child, or parent, but nothing less compelling. And of course, Congress had a reason in making these very stringent standards. They were trying to prevent aliens, as I think, Judge Wood, you were mentioning before, I mean, there's always this potential for delay. And it's very easy for aliens who gain a lot by staying here indefinitely.
What's
percentage of the people in your proceedings are non-English speakers, just don't understand English at all?
I don't know what the percentage is, but of course they have interpreters available.
Right. That's what I'm interested in, the fact that the board relies entirely on the oral communications of interpreters for these non-English speakers.
There's written notices.
They give them written notes in English, but if you don't speak English, it may not be useful.
Petitioner was represented by counsel. Petitioner got oral notice and petitioner got written notice. Written notice is in this record, I believe it's at AR-95, of the date on which she subsequently did not appear. Now, her situation here, her claimed mistake or confusion, meets none of the statutory requirements. It seems to me that the situation is not like the facts in Nazarova, where Nazarova was in a situation she had no reason to anticipate, and she didn't know how to deal with it. She had not received any previous instructions.
Well, Nazarova was worse because the agency had affirmatively misled her about her situation. So I agree with you.
In this situation in front of us, this woman had been at hearings a number of times. She'd been told over and over again that there were severe consequences if she failed to show up for a hearing. She knew how serious this was. She was then given oral notice and written notice. She had an attorney, and yet she still didn't show up. Now, if Congress's intent of being tough in these situations doesn't apply to this woman, when can it apply ever? So I really feel that's important. Now, I know that the opposing counsel is pushing this Ranjit Singh, and I urge this court to resist that. Nazarova did not accept the principle of Ranjit Singh, did not accept this idea that, we're not going to look so much at why the person failed to show up, which is the only thing Congress was interested in, the only thing. Ranjit Singh says, we're going to look at whether she would have been eligible if she did show up. This court has never taken that route, and I strongly urge you not to take that route now, especially in this case, which I just don't think the merits of this case should tempt you to do that, and I think it's a bad policy call to go in that direction.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Stephan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Camelli, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Your Honor, you were just urged not to follow Singh. What it means is that you should not follow Chaudhary versus INS, the Seventh Circuit case, because Singh, in reality, talks about Chaudhary. In Singh, the Ninth Circuit indicated, we agree with the Seventh Circuit that the INS should not deny reopening of an in absentia deportation order where the denial leads to the unconscionable result of deporting an individual eligible for relief from deportation, and that has been mentioned in our brief in page 13. Are we encouraging this court not to follow its own precedent? I respectfully request the court to reverse the BIA decision because it will be unconscionable not to allow Ms. Yurisdiki to apply for adjustment of status in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Camelli. Thank you to both counsel.